In our study of the book of Revelation, we are going to be considering the seventh chapter in our study tonight. I'd ask you to go back, and I think it's very important for us to keep in mind the general outline of the book in terms of the things that we want to learn and try to remember from where they are located in the book, to keep in mind somewhat of an outline of those things. And we're going to be talking, like I said, from the seventh chapter. But as we go back to the first chapter, chapter 1 through chapter 11, we're talking about God's saints on earth, the problems and difficulties that John is being presented. In the first chapter, in verse 1, we note that John is being told some things which must shortly come to pass. We've noted that it is revealed in signs and symbols in verse 1 of chapter 1. We've also noted, beginning in verse 4 and in verse 11, this is addressed to the seven churches of Asia Minor. We've noted in the latter verses of the first chapter, the source of this material in particular is from Jesus, as John sees him presented in a very glorious fashion. And then in chapters 2 and 3, we read of the letters to the seven churches of Asia Minor. We've discussed them in some detail. We've noted that they're not just simply seven churches in Asia Minor, but these indicate the totality of all churches, I think, for all time, and typical problems that might exist in churches relative to our teaching, relative to our stand, and relative to our persecution. And then in chapters 4 and 5, what I believe to be a grander view of the throne scene, that helps us to understand that God is in control. And of course, the points that we're wanting to note, just here is that, the throne of God is presented, and I've done something to, get back over on those things. In the fourth chapter, God is presented as being on the throne, and the 24 elders and the 4 living creatures around the throne, and they're singing praise unto him. We see the song of eternity, and then beginning in verse 11, the song of creation. And then in the fifth chapter, the scene turns somewhat. John sees someone holding a book, and he sees a very strong angel proclaiming with a great voice, verse 2, who is worthy to open the book and to loose the seals thereof. And John is very sad because he doesn't see anybody to open the book. But then the Lamb is presented standing as one had been slain and described there beginning in verse 6 and 7. And then we see the scene somewhat change. We see the 4 living creatures, then the 24 elders joining in worship of the Lamb. And then the chapter closes with worship unto him that sits on the throne and to the Lamb. And the 4 living creatures say amen, and the elders fall down and worship. And then beginning in chapter 6, we see the opening of the seals. Now, interestingly enough, we've studied from chapter 6 and the presentation of the horses and what their riders seem to bring as they come forth. And then the consequence of that, as those who would be the objects of the wrath that is displayed, crying to the mountains to fall on them and hide us from the face of him that sitteth on the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb. Now, the reason for that as an introduction, you see in verse 17 of chapter 6, for the great day of their wrath is come. And then the question is asked, and who is able to stand? Now, that becomes the jumping board or springboard into the seventh chapter. The great day of his wrath has come. And John's concern is what will happen to God's people. Now, I think it's important at this point that we see that John is a fellow sufferer of this tribulation. And so his question, in essence, what will happen to God's people, are those that he sees in suffering, in tribulation and anguish, who are suffering at the hands of those who apparently are on their way to becoming the victors and the in this conquest. And the writer is telling them that no, God's people are not going to be defeated. So what will become of God's people? I want us to notice some things that are peculiar. And Richard, I want to call your attention. I had, I think, verse 7 on some previous charts I sent to you. This says chapter 7. This is corrected. This is the latest, greatest edition that I just sent to you to avoid confusion. But I want to note also that Amos tells us that two cannot walk together except they be agreed. And that the things that God is going to bring upon these who are his enemies, he will reveal through the words of the prophets. And so what we want to note here from these Old Testament texts, Amos chapter 3, verse 3, and then in verse 7, is that God is telling them the answer to the question, what about God's people? He's about to tell John what will occur and how it will affect God's people. Now, the seventh chapter, I want you to note, answers this question. And the answer is God's people are going to be protected by God. They're not going to be defeated. Now, the seventh chapter somewhat interrupts the discussion of the opening of the seals. Donna asked me a while ago, she said, what do you mean by the word interlude? And I didn't use the word intermission, but it's similar. Something is being interrupted and something now is injected somewhat as a parenthesis, and then something is later to resume. And that's what we see in chapter 8 with the resuming of the opening of the seals, the seventh seal, chapter 8, verse 1. In this chapter, we see an interruption of that discussion of the opening of the seals. And in this, we see the sealing of the 144,000. And we'll discuss that in verses 1 through verse 8. And then we see in verses 9 through 17, another picture, a great multitude around the throne. Now, what does this mean? The sealing of 144,000, and then what does the picture of the great multitude around the throne, what does that all mean? Now, as we begin our study tonight, as we read verse 1, and after this, I saw four angels standing at the four corners of the earth, holding the four winds of the earth, that no wind should blow on the earth or on the sea or upon any tree. Now, Randy Childs, you've made note in your reading of the text the importance of this number four as a world number. And what we want to see here is that often in the book of Revelation, we see things listed with triplets, the number three, as we do here, four angels, four corners, four winds. And then we want to note that sometimes we see things like in this passage that the wind should not blow upon the earth, the sea, or any tree. And we're going to see later in this same chapter the identification of seven things. And that becomes a repetition or a sequence that's common in the writing of the book of Revelation. But what we have is a continuation of the events surrounding the opening of the sixth seal now from the previous chapter. And this then presents an interruption to the opening of these seals. Now, the thing that I find interesting, we've got two primary, what I call interludes. That's what most of those who write on the book of Revelation refer to, chapter 7 and then chapter 10. Both of them essentially answering the same question in a different context, but answering essentially the same question. And that is, what happens to Christians during this terrible time of persecution? Now, winds. We've noted in the text that these four angels were standing upon the four corners of the earth, holding the four winds of the earth. Now, we mentioned in our, well, numerous previous studies that the language of the book of Revelation is language that is frequently taken from the Old Testament books. And though there's not anything in the Old Testament that I'm aware of that's verbatim quoted in the book of Revelation, there are numerous references to some of these things. I think there are over 400 allusions to some Old Testament text. But if you'll open your Bible to Jeremiah chapter 49 and look with me, beginning actually in verse 34. In verse 34, it says, the word of Jehovah that came to Jeremiah the prophet concerning Elam in the beginning of the reign of Zedekiah, king of Judah, saying, "Thus saith Jehovah of hosts, behold, I will break the bow of Elam, the chief of their night. And upon Elam will I bring the four winds from the four quarters of heaven, and will scatter them toward all those winds. And there shall be no nation, whether the outcast of Elam shall not come." Now, I'll leave it to you to study about the Elamites and the Edomites and the mention of Damascus and Kedar in Jeremiah chapter 49. But be it known that these are those who have presented themselves as enemies of God's people. And he's pronouncing judgment upon them. He identifies the four winds. Now, that language is fairly consistent in the book of Jeremiah. If you'll note in Jeremiah chapter 51 in verse 1, it says, "Thus saith Jehovah, behold, I will raise up against Babylon and against them that dwell in Libkema a destroying wind." Now, you keep reading and you see that the use of this terminology is quite common in the Old Testament. If you'll skip over the book of Ezekiel and go to the book of Daniel in the 7th chapter and in verse 1, Daniel chapter 7 in verse 1, "In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel had a dream and visions of his head upon his bed. Then he wrote the dream and told the sum of the matter. In verse 2, Daniel spake and said, I saw in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of heaven break forth upon the great sea." Now, I'll leave it to you to read further in the 7th chapter, but I want to ask you the question, in these references, what is it that these Old Testament texts are talking about when they use the expression four winds? Well, I have it on the screen just to give you a hint. He's talking about the judgments that are brought upon the inhabitants of these places by God. I think that's the way that it's used here in Revelation chapter 7. He's not talking necessarily about the direction from which the wind comes. He's talking about those who would present themselves as representatives of God in judgment upon certain peoples. We see that language in the Old Testament, and I think we see that here, but with a difference here. In Jeremiah 49 and Jeremiah 51 and Daniel 7, we note that God would bring these judgments. But in Revelation chapter 7, what's the difference? Anybody? Do you see a difference? He saw these four angels standing at the four corners of the earth, holding the four winds, that no wind should blow upon the earth or upon the sea or upon any tree until, and we see that then discussed in verse 2.
Matter of divine restraint here.
Yes, sir. That's exactly what he's discussing. Divine restraint. This judgment would not come until God desired that this judgment would come. And we see similar occurrences of this expression in the book of Ezekiel. I said I would skip that. I'm going to come back to it later, so I'm not skipping it altogether. But we will come back to that in just a little bit from Ezekiel chapter 9. What we want to note here, especially in chapter 7, is all suffering is not the judgment of God. Now, you'll note, as we've discussed already, that Christians that would first read the book of Revelation were Christians that were suffering. Some of them, as we've noted in chapter 2, verse 13, were suffering martyrdom. We studied there about a man who had lost his life. Antipas had lost his life because of the persecution of that day. Of course, we go back to Acts chapter 12, and we can read about James being the first of the apostles, that he was beheaded. So suffering was a reality during New Testament times. And what we want to note, just because you were a Christian, this passage in Revelation chapter 7 is not giving you a free pass that you won't suffer any kind of persecution for, because they were being persecuted. Many of them were becoming martyrs because of their faith. Now, what we also want to note, and this was the problem in the book of Job that we talked about briefly in our study this morning, some equated punishment and suffering to say, well, if you're suffering, that means you've done something wrong. Well, certainly that was not the case with Job. He was not suffering because he had done something wrong. And these in the book of Revelation, they were not suffering persecution because they had done something wrong. Antipas didn't lose his life because he'd done something wrong. We're reading in this book about those who were suffering because of their faith. They were suffering because they were Christians. They were not being punished for something they did that was wrong. We also want to note that the righteous that are discussed in Revelation chapter 7 are sealed against judgment, but that doesn't mean that they're exempt from any kind of suffering. And that's the subject matter, of course, that permeates the book of Revelation. Now, we've noted the number four, man's number, or number for the world. We've noted that here are angels standing and ready to act. And this expression is typically used in both Old and New Testament, the four corners of the earth, the north, south, east, and west, to indicate that the earth was not to be hurt, not merely Judea. I think that's crucial because that hits at those who become the objects of the recipients of this book. That is, whether it's dealing with the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70 or not. The judgment that's being spoken of here in Revelation chapter 7 that's being restrained is not just geographically local. It's not just a certain city, because it's described as affecting the four corners of the earth. Now, in view of that, these winds, we've talked about them, and they would be designed to bring hurt and destruction. But now they're kept in check until God is ready. The text tells us until God's seal is placed on the foreheads of the believers. He's holding back judgment until the command to attack, as it were, is given. I think this is important. This indicates that he's not talking about final judgment in the second coming of Christ. And I think that's especially crucial in the light of the mention of the 144,000, because if you're talking with a Jehovah's Witness, he's going to look at Revelation 7 and Revelation 14 and identify specifically the 144,000 as a select group of people that is finite in its definition. A select group of people. I've talked with Jehovah's Witnesses before, and they say, well, we're not going to be among that number of 144,000. Our reward is going to be on this earth, but the 144,000, an exact number, is going to be those who are privileged to be taken to heaven. I don't believe he's talking about the final judgment any more than he's talking about a literal 144,000. But let's notice verse 2, and then we'll have opportunity for some questions or comments if you have such. In verse 2, it says, "And I saw another angel ascend from sunrising, having the seal of the living God. And he cried with a great voice to the four angels to whom it was given to hurt the earth and the sea, saying, hurt not the earth, neither the sea nor the trees, till we shall have sealed the servants of our God on their foreheads." Now, you'll notice again in the context of this, the message of this angel was these four are to be restrained and hurt not the earth, neither the sea nor the trees, till we shall have sealed the servants of our God. So here's something that is to happen. And this is not going to happen until God is ready for this to happen. Now, one of the things that I think we need to just pause and notice in passing is what the work of angels really was. In verse 7 of Hebrews chapter 1, the writer said, "And of the angels, he saith, who make his angels winds, and his ministers a flame of fire." Now, the context of this in Hebrews chapter 1 is to simply show that God said some things about his Son that he did not say to the angels. But in that context, he tells us what angels do. He made his angels winds. And just in a superficial reading of that, we might come away and say, well, I don't understand. What is it that angels do? They're made to be winds. Well, when we look at these Old Testament texts of Ezekiel chapter 9 and some of these others that we've mentioned, we want to note that angels have the power and the ability to bring judgment upon certain ones. And when 185,000 woke up dead, they did that, yes, because an angel came through the camp of the king of Assyria when he was preparing to attack the city of Jerusalem during the reign of Hezekiah. And, of course, that angel killed 185,000 of his soldiers. And if one angel can do that, we see as the term winds is used in Jeremiah and in Ezekiel, and as it's used, I believe, here in Hebrews chapter 1, verse 7, angels sometimes were used as God's ministers to pronounce judgment upon certain people. And we saw that in the text that we alluded to with the 185,000, and I'll leave that to you to find that. By the way, it's in 1 Kings, I believe. I'd have to look for it.
Mickey,
but that's, yes.
Wasn't that an angel that went over the children of Israel and, or the people in Egypt and killed the firstborn?
Yes. 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 So God used angels, and we've got instances that we can cite, for that in times past to pronounce his judgment upon people. Now, we also want to note that this angel was from the east. He had the seal of the living God. And he said, you wait until we mark these with the seal of God on their foreheads. Now, this mark is not something really that's all that strange to our ears, because that's where I want to turn back to Ezekiel chapter 9. I think I may have that on the next chart. Let me look real quickly. Okay, well, that's all right. We'll get it. Okay. All right, we'll get it. But if you'll open your Bible to the Old Testament text of Ezekiel chapter 9, I want to begin reading in verse 1. Ezekiel chapter 9, verse 1. Now, I know that's here in the Old Testament. Let me get to it. Ezekiel, there it is, chapter 9, verse 1. Here the writer says, then he cried in mine ears with a loud voice, saying, cause them that have charge over the city to draw near, every man with his destroying weapon in his hand. And behold, six men came from the way of the upper gate, which lieth toward the north, every man with his slaughter weapon in his hand, and one man in the midst of them clothed in linen with the writer's inkhorn by his side. And they went in and stood beside the brazen altar. Now look carefully, verse 3. And the glory of God, the God of Israel, was gone up from the cherub upon it was, the cherub whereupon it was, to the threshold of the house of God, of the house. And he called to the man clothed in linen who had the writer's inkhorn by his side. And Jehovah said unto him, go through the midst of the city, go through the midst of Jerusalem, and set a mark upon the foreheads of the men that sigh and that cry over all the abominations that are done in the midst thereof. And to the others he said, in my hearing, go ye through the city after him, and smite, and let not your eyes spare, neither have ye pity. Slay utterly the old man, and the young man, the virgin, and the little children and women, but come not near any man upon whom is the mark, and begin at my sanctuary. And they began at the old man, men that were before the house. Now, we could read on just a little bit, but that gets the point that I'm trying to make. In Ezekiel chapter 9, what are we reading about? Ezekiel chapter 9, beginning in verse 1. Are we not reading about judgment that is pronounced upon God's people? And as judgment is being pronounced, we see that there is a remnant. Has there not always been a remnant? Even among God's people, there has always been a remnant. And this Old Testament text of Ezekiel chapter 9, before the slaughter began, what was to take place? We see one that was to go through and mark the foreheads of those who mourn over the condition of God's people.
That's protecting the remnant.
That's protecting the remnant. That's right. Thank you. And so what we see then is anyone, man, woman, boy, or girl, that didn't have this mark, they were to be slaughtered. But those who were marked were to be spared. Now, is that how John is writing here in Revelation chapter 7? Well, yes. He's identifying that a mark was to be placed upon the foreheads of the 144,000, and they were to be spared. They were not to be harmed. Now, this idea of a seal or a mark, we see that it serves several purposes. A seal may serve against tampering. I know somebody that is a truck driver, and if my son-in-law can hear this, he probably knows that this is so, sometimes things are put in the cargo area of a truck, and a seal is put on the door of the truck so that when the driver delivers it, it verifies that nothing has been tampered with. The seal has not been broken, and the contents of the truck are just as they were when it was loaded. We see also that a seal shows ownership. Now, this becomes very important to our study as we turn to 2 Timothy chapter 2 and in verse 19. Those of you who are studying with us on Tuesday night, we're going to get to this eventually. But in 2 Timothy chapter 2 in verse 19, the writer says, "Howbeit the firm foundation of God standeth, having this seal, the Lord knoweth them that are his. And let everyone that nameth the name of the Lord depart from unrighteousness." I simply want to make this notation here that a seal serves to show ownership. And so it does in 2 Timothy chapter 2, and I think it does as well in our text of Revelation chapter 7. Another purpose that a seal shows is it certifies genuineness. Randy Bowles, I'm just kind of rattling here. If you would, Randy Bowles, would you turn to Esther chapter 3 and read for me verse 12? Esther chapter 3 and verse 12. Please. Esther chapter 3 verse 12. You have it there? If you don't, I've got it. Okay, I'm going to go ahead. In Esther chapter 3, verse 12, "Then were the king's scribes called in the first month on the 13th day thereof, and there was written according to all that Haman commanded unto the king's satraps and to the governors that were over every province and to the princes of every people, to every province according to the writing thereof, and to every people after their language in the name of King Ahasuerus was it written, and it was sealed with the king's ring." Now, we talked about seals when we talked about the seven seals initially, and we noted that sometimes a seal is used to certify something to be genuine, and perhaps you have done this to take a ring or a stamp or something, and you melt some wax and you put it on the seal of an envelope, and then you impress that into it, and that's another means of identification of not only ownership, but it sometimes in the instance of a king's ring, it tells you the source of it. So you have the certification of the genuineness of the writing. And that's the case here in Esther chapter 3, as this letter was sent by the king unto the satraps. Christians are under God's protection, purchased by the blood of Christ and certified by the Spirit to be the sons of God. In Romans chapter 8 and in verse 8, beginning in verse 16, we learn that the Spirit bears witness with our spirit that we are indeed children of God. Here is the certification, the seal, as it were, of the Spirit. And here's the chart that had that on it that I was looking for a few moments ago, Ezekiel chapter 9, verses 1 through 11, to mark those that were spared from the wrath of God. Now, let me pause just here before we start verse 4 with the identifying the 144,000 and open the floor for a question or a comment that you might have before we start into another line of thought. Anybody, question or comment?
Hey, Mickey, I was also thinking, you know, about Lot, you know, how God sent the angels, you know, to protect Lot. Yeah. You know, during that time, you know, it may not have been a whole group of people, but, you know, it was just two angels that protected his family.
Okay. Okay.
So many other cases where God sent angels to protect his people.
I'll admit to you that I don't know, or I don't understand, I guess I should say, all I know about the work of angels. But we do see them working as ministers of God's wrath and referred to as winds there in Hebrews chapter 1 and some of these Old Testament texts. That's right, Bruce. That's a whole pretty involved study to study what angels do. But what we want to note here is, yes.
You want to know about the 185,000 waking up dead?
Yes. What's the passage on that?
It's 2 Kings 19.
Second Kings 19. Okay. Very good. Thank you.
And then it's referenced again in Isaiah 37:36.
Yes. Those are parallel texts. One by the prophet and one account by, as it's Chronicles in the Chronicles of the Kings. Thank you, Randy.
You're welcome.
In verse 4 of Revelation 7, the writer said, "And I heard the number of them that were sealed, 144,000, sealed out of every tribe of the children of Israel." Now this gives us the number. And as we keep reading in this, it tells us of the tribe, and I want you to notice carefully the list here. Of the tribe of Judah were sealed 12,000. Of the tribe of Reuben, 12,000. Of the tribe of Gad, 12,000. Of the tribe of Asher, 12,000. Of the tribe of Naphtali, 12,000. Of the tribe of Manasseh, 12,000. Of the tribe of Simeon, 12,000. Of the tribe of Levi, 12,000. Of the tribe of Issachar, 12,000. Of the tribe of Zebulun, 12,000. Of the tribe of Joseph, 12,000. Of the tribe of Benjamin were sealed 12,000. Now, in the reading of this, sometimes folks ask the question, well, why do we have the listing in the order that we do, and why the naming of certain ones that are in the list and some that are actually not found in the list? Well, we'll talk about that, but I want to look first, as I have it on this chart, this number of 144,000. Now, again, if you talk with a Jehovah's Witness, he's got that as an exact number, 144,000. I want to suggest to you that the context won't allow that. First of all, the seal is not a literal seal. The four corners are not four specific corners. This is an expression that's used in Scripture. And then the 12 tribes, we're going to have to talk about that in greater detail. As you see on the chart, I want to remind myself to discuss that more just a little bit. But if we already have identified here in first century times the sealing of 144,000 that were contemporary with John, where does that put you? Where does that put anybody after the generation of John? If they're all, we're already sealed 144,000, and this is an exact number of those that would go to heaven, then only those of John's generation or before would have that privilege. It couldn't be 144,001. And friend, that would exclude you altogether. You're way too late, because the 144,000 were sealed here in John's day. Now, the text is very specific. But we know how the number 12 is used in the book of Revelation. We've noted that the number 12 is used to describe organized religion. And now it's multiplied. 12, now 144 times 10 times 10 times 10. 144,000, which means all, a complete number of saints are being cared for. Not an exact number, but a complete number. All of God's saints are being cared for. Now, the thing that I find really interesting, and we'll discuss this more as we go along into some of these later chapters, but there are two groups that are contrasted in the book of Revelation. There are those who receive the seal of God, as we find it here, and then there are those who received the mark or seal of the beast, as we'll see in some of these later chapters. Now, the significance of that, I think, is quite remarkable, and we'll develop that in greater detail as we go along. But first of all, let us talk about the 144,000 that is identified here. strangely enough, it's not only in Revelation 7 that are mentioned 144,000. Now, I'm going to come back to the upper part of that chart that you see in just a moment. But for now, let's turn to Revelation chapter 14 and notice some things where this term is used again. In Revelation chapter 14, we see who the 144,000 are and who they are not. In Revelation 14, I want to begin in verse 1. He said, "And I saw, and behold, the Lamb standing on the Mount Zion, and with him 144,000 having his name and the name of his Father written on their foreheads." I want to suggest to you that this is the same 144,000 that we see in Revelation chapter 7. The same mark or identifying element is the same one that identifies those people. And then in verse 2, John said, chapter 14, "I heard a voice from heaven, as the voice of many waters, and as the voice of a great thunder. And the voice which I heard was as the voice of harpers harping with their harps. And they sing, as it were, a new song before the throne, and before the four living creatures and the elders. And no man could learn the song, save the 144,000, even they that had been purchased out of the earth. These are they that were not defiled with women, for they were virgins. These are they that followed the Lamb whithersoever he goeth. These were purchased from among men to be the first fruits unto God and unto the Lamb. And in their mouth was found no lie. They are without blemish." Now, do you see the 144,000 identified in very specific terms? The 144,000 in Revelation chapter 14 are those who sing a new song. The 144,000 in Revelation chapter 14 are those who have not defiled themselves with women. Now, I want to suggest to you that he's not talking about those literally who are virgins. Certainly we know that those who are ungodly and immoral, those who are homosexuals and fornicators and adulterers in 1 Corinthians chapter 6 and verses 9 through 11 shall not inherit the kingdom of God. But I don't think that's how the word is used in this context. The word used in this context are those who have not defiled themselves with erroneous teaching or with false worship. Those who follow the Lamb. Well, we see that in Revelation chapter 7 in verse 13. It said, "And one of the elders answered, saying unto me, these that are arrayed in the white robes, who are they and whence came they?" Well, as you read the rest of the text down through verse 17, these are those who are following the Lamb. That's who the 144,000 are. Furthermore, you'll notice in the text of Revelation 14 in verse 3 and 4, these are those who were purchased out of the earth. Well, who is that? In Revelation chapter 5, as we've already studied, in verse 9, in the singing of this new song, the four living creatures and the 24 elders sing, "Worthy art thou to take the book and to open the seals thereof, for thou wast slain and didst purchase unto God with thy blood men of every tribe and tongue and people and nation, and madest them to be unto our God a kingdom and priests, and they reign upon the earth." Who are those folks that are purchased out of the earth by the blood of the Lamb? Well, you'd be correct if you said, well, that's talking about Christians. That's right. You'll notice further that these are those who are described as the first fruits of God, or unto God and the Lamb. These who do not lie in Revelation 14. These who are without blemish. That is, they're not the ones who are perpetrating this false teaching. They're not following the false teaching. These are those who are faithful and true, as we've described them before in earlier chapters of our study. These are those who are following the Lamb. Now, who would that be? Well, he says, and going back in our text of Revelation chapter 7, reading in verse 4, "And I heard the number of them that were sealed, 144,000, sealed out of every tribe of the children of Israel." Now, is he simply talking about those who are of Jewish descent? Or is he talking about those who are children of God, those who are of the Israel of God? As we have looked at this before in our study of the book of Revelation, in fact, two or three times. Oh, okay, thank you. That sneaked up on me. Thank you. Well, I want to note very quickly just a few of the passages that we have on the board. Let's look at Galatians 6 and Romans 2, and I think that will suffice to get our point. In Galatians chapter 6 and in verse 16, the churches of Galatia were troubled by Judaizing teachers, binding the practice of circumcision, and Paul deals with that specifically throughout the book. But if you'll note in verse 16 of Galatians chapter 6, there the writer said, "As many as shall walk by this rule, peace be upon them and mercy and upon the Israel of God." Is Paul using the term Israel here to describe fleshly Israel? Well, no. No, he's using it to talk about the churches of Galatia and churches generally, as Paul uses it in the Roman letter, as we mentioned in chapter 2, beginning in verse 28. Romans chapter 2, verse 28, "For he is not a Jew who is one outwardly, neither is that circumcision which is outward in the flesh, but he is a Jew who is one inwardly, and circumcision is that of the heart, in the spirit, not in the letter, whose praise is not of men, but of God." Now, those who constitute the tribes of Israel, no, we're not talking about the physical nation of Israel that would receive this mark, but we're talking about those who were members of the Lord's church. We're talking about Christians who would be identified and spared from much of this terrible persecution that would be the judgment that would be pronounced upon those who were inflicting persecution upon God's people. Now, having said that, when you talk to those like Jehovah's Witnesses and others who take the futurist interpretation of the book, we've got a problem. Are we talking about literally those who are of the physical descent of Israel who would be under God's protection? Or is that expanded to include any of these who were persecuted because of their faith? Must they be only men? That is, men who have never married or never known a woman? And if these are Jews, how will one be able to identify what tribe they're from? Because we know that the books of the genealogies have long been gone. They were much destroyed by Herod, the king, but we know that they were destroyed by Titus, the Roman general, who destroyed the city of Jerusalem in 70 AD. No Jew today can accurately know what tribe he's from based upon the genealogical records. There are none. And again, I ask you to specifically notice the listing of the tribes, because in the listing here, Dan and Ephraim are not included. And that raises the question, well, why? Well, we'll talk about that. But what we want to note just here is, to answer this question, who was it that was sealed? It was those from every tribe of the sons of Israel. Now, if we're talking about spiritual Israel, we're simply talking about all of God's people in the age of the context of the book of Revelation. They received a seal to identify who they were. These were Christians, God's people, not specifically fleshly Israel. Now, I ask the question, why this particular listing of tribes? Normally, we do not think of Joseph as a tribe, but he is listed in this passage. And what we do want to note is that because Joseph received the birthright, the double portion, and you can go back and read about that in 1 Chronicles 5, his sons, usually in the listing, are seen as Ephraim and Manasseh, and they received territory in the promised land. But in this listing, we see Manasseh is listed, or is not listed, but Ephraim is, or Manasseh is listed in the text, and Ephraim is not. I guess I got that turned around. But we also note that Dan is omitted. Now, that raises an interesting question about why, and I'm not sure I know the answer to it. Perhaps it's because Dan and Ephraim are generally associated with practices of idolatry. And I'll suggest that you go back and study 2 Kings chapter 2 when Jeroboam the first was king over the northern 10 tribes, and he set up places of idol worship in Dan and in Bethel and told the Israelites, it's too much for you to go down to the city of Jerusalem. We note that those who practiced idolatry are specifically identified as having their part in the lake that burns with fire and brimstone in chapter 21 and in verse 8. Now, these that were sealed, God's judgments were cunning, but those that were sealed would not be hurt, as it were. In other words, they would not be destroyed by these judgments, but rather, as we look at Romans chapter 8, and we'll have to come back to this next time, they are promised that they would be more than conquerors because they are Christians, because of their relationship of being in Christ. Now, I'm going to stop there, and I want you to do some homework for next time and see if you find a difference between the sealing of the 144,000 in verses 1 through 8 and the great multitude that is round about the throne in verses 9 through 17. And I'll give you a heads up as to where I'm going with that. I don't believe they're different. There are those who think that these two groups are indeed separate groups. I think it's just another picture of the same group. And we'll talk more about that in our next study. I'm going to stop sharing my screen just now and, again, open the floor if you have a question or a comment. Now's the time.
You know, Mickey, I was looking and thinking about in the book of Genesis, where Genesis chapter 28, I believe it's verse 13, where God says, gave Abraham the promise as far as the east from the west and the north and the south that his seed will multiply all the way to there. And he wasn't talking about, he was talking about the seed promise, and that seed promise is spiritual. And, and I believe that this is what he, you know, that this is what he's talking about, that fulfillment.
Good.
It's even more than that. It's spiritual. It's not just physical.
Yeah. I think that's right. Good. Any other questions or comments? Well, I told Donna a while ago as we were talking about the book of Revelation, I said right now we're kind of getting into some of the more difficult context of the book of Revelation. So don't think I've got all the answers. I may not. In fact, I'll tell you straight up, I don't think I do. But we'll study and hopefully learn together. Anything further?
Mickey?
Yes, sir.
Just a thought that the Watchtower Society cut off the access to heaven back in 1935. Only 144,000 JWs were able to go to heaven. So that's how far out some people take the Book of Revelation.
Yeah.
Just as a caution.
Yes. Yeah. There's just so much that's wrong with that. It's hard to go down and identify all of it. But yes, that's true. Thank you, Dan. One of the things that, I'm sorry, Daphne.
I was going to say a lot of times when you're talking to people like that who have that sort of literal view, if you go to the list and says they have to be this, they have to be this, they have to be that. And if you're going to take this literally, then you have to take that literally. So are you a male? Do you have children? And are you one of the tribes? And if they say no, it's like, well, that's it for the rapture for you. You know?
Yeah, you're not on the list.
That makes them actually stop and go, me think about that, because I was pretty sure I'm going to be one of the raptured ones. So, you know, it's just, you just got to poke a hole sometimes in that wall. Yeah. And that's a good way to do it.
Well, it is. And I've got a book that I somewhat treasure, especially when I'm talking with Jehovah's Witnesses, because it's written by Judge Rutherford, who was their second in command after Charles Taze Russell. And Judge Rutherford, in this book, the book is called Millions Now Living Will Never Die. Your dad may have a copy of it. But I have one, and they're not all that easy to, or used to not be all that easy to obtain. It is a Bible, Watchtower Bible and Tract Society book. And one of the things that I like to note in it when I'm studying with a Jehovah's Witness is, first of all, look at the first page of the book and identify that this is one of yours. Well, they do and agree. Yeah, that's got our logo in it. And then I ask them to turn to a certain page and read this paragraph or so, because it identifies that Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob would be raised from the dead in 1914 and live, I believe, is in Los Angeles or San Diego. And so they were to build a mansion, which they did. Of course, the hierarchy of the Jehovah's Witness lived there, and Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob were not raised from the dead, and so it was. And the book, I think I may have misspoke on the dates. I think the book was written about 1914, and the fulfillment of that being 1925, I think. I'd have to go back and refresh my memory. But be that as it may, 1914, 1925, they're both come and gone, and Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob were not raised from the dead. And so I showed this to one of the folks I was studying with, and he said, well, that just goes to show that you can't place your trust and faith in men. Yeah, but this one of your fellows who claimed to be a prophet that you claim to follow. And so our study was over, and he and his friend got up and left. And that's typical, but we need to know these things. If we're going to talk with somebody, for example, who is of Jehovah's Witness background, and not just, I don't mean to pick on Jehovah's Witness, there's a whole bunch of folks in denominational religions that have the 144,000 identified, and they take the futuristic approach to the book of Revelation. It's prophesying yet something that is to come that includes them, with some very specific prophecies. And anyway, be that as it may, we don't want to close this study or any other study without extending to you the opportunity to obey the Lord, in fact, the invitation to do that. So if it be your desire to contact Chris or I or Richard or any of us to help you to become a Christian by baptizing you into Christ, that's what we would like to do. We'd like to help you to do the things that you know you need to do. You believe that Jesus is the Christ. It's your desire to turn from your sin, confess your faith. We'll help you to be baptized into that relationship where your sins are forgiven. And if you be subject to the Lord's invitation in another way, if you've just simply not been faithful, not been doing the things that you know you need to do, you'd like for us to pray with you and for you, then we'd be delighted to do that. In fact, we would solicit not only prayers on your behalf, but ours, that we can overcome the difficulties and sin that often raises its ugly head in our lives and help us to do better in times of such need. So please make that known.